This is Advanced D&D, a podcast hosted by Dan Wu and DeBron Thomas on WUKY. It is episode 31, and as most of our conversations have gone, well, there's going to be a lot to talk about in this episode. We've got the latest coming out of ESPN. We'll also talk about Pfizer and catch up on this week at Anderson .Paak and talk some movies and TV shows and a lot more. That's coming right here on Advanced D&D on WUKY. In this cycle of life, Dan, that is just forever news, I feel like it's a good time to be in news because there's always something to talk about. But especially this week, it's been a heavy one.
Yeah, it's been some interesting stuff happening. Social media, particularly Facebook and Instagram, have been sort of in the spotlight again after a former employee of Facebook came out as a whistleblower. I think she did a national interview and then was promptly asked to speak in front of Congress. And she basically, the gist of it is, she testified that Facebook, the company who's the parent company of Instagram, they know all the harm that their platforms are either doing or abetting. Like, they have this information, they've done these internal studies, and yet they don't do anything about it. So in particular, in terms of Facebook, there's a lot of promotion, you know, and of hate speech and inflammatory stuff and disinformation and misinformation. And I will just say this from a personal level, I feel like just anecdotally, the kind of posts that I'm making on Facebook anymore get no traction whatsoever. They get very few views, very few likes. And I'm realizing, you know, in the beginning, I'm just like, are people just not following me and looking at this stuff anymore? And it's algorithms. It's algorithms that are the most inflammatory, are the ones that cause the most kind of reactions, are the ones that end up getting pushed to the top of your feed. If you look at your Facebook feed on any given day, it is not by chronological order. It is literally just this weird mishmash of things that they think you're interested in or they want you to be interested in. On the Instagram side, there have been studies that have proven that Instagram is terribly harmful for young people, in particular teen and teenage girls, in terms of body image and self-image and depression and all this kind of stuff. So it's not like we don't know. They know this stuff and they just don't want to do anything about it because it runs counter to them making lots of money. So the question is, and this is one of the few things that we have bipartisan consensus on. It seems like lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are concerned about this and seemingly want to lay a heavy hand onto the likes of Facebook and Instagram. So my question is social media the new tobacco? Is it going to start getting hit with this sort of regulatory attention?
Well, you know, Dan, 1971 was 50 years ago, and it turned 50 years ago on January 1st, believe it or not. And there are many songs, many pieces of art that speak to this kind of consumption and, you know, just the overall plight of us trying to make it through things. And why are those things still relevant? Because not much has changed. You know, to quote Gil Scott-Heron, he once said, when it comes to people's safety, money wins every time. And I think that that is incredibly true. Yes, they are aware of what these things do. And I mean, and I will say that I have a weird relationship with social media because I think that when utilized in the way of, you know, in its original intention, that's not rating people, that in the intention of actually connecting with people and, you know, meeting people in your field or using the platform to kind of like advance some causes and things like that in the real world, it is helpful. And the way the internet is, as you already know, is like anytime there's a good bit of anything when it comes to the internet, there it's easily outweighed by the negativity. And the fact that Facebook already knows that they have this data, they have no excuse to say, well, we didn't know. No, it's true. They just want, they're there for their bottom line, which is to continue to make money. So I'm with you. I definitely feel like long term, we'll be able to have a conversation about social media like we did with tobacco. And I'm curious to see what the long term effects of it, because, I mean, I don't know about you, but that's how I reach out to a lot of people these days, especially given that, you know, the pandemic, and it's been helpful in that way. But yeah, it's it'll be interesting to see where things go.
Yeah, I think for a lot of us, we have this very, it's not even a love hate, it's like a need hate. A lot of us just, you know, especially those of us who run small businesses or have sort of independent commercial, you know, things going on, like Facebook and Instagram very often is our means of like advertising our businesses. So we can't really do without it. At the same time, we're living with sort of the toxicity that surrounds it. In COVID news, Pfizer and I believe very soon Moderna and J&J are going to start asking for emergency use authorization for vaccines for kids, 5 to 11-year-olds. The science has basically said that an unvaccinated kid is less likely to be hospitalized than a vaccinated senior. Kids, by and large, that has been shown in the last couple of years, don't get sick as often and don't get sick as badly. Do we want vaccines for kids? Absolutely, we do, to keep that sort of mass vaccination, mass immunization thing going. Is it the most effective thing that's going to happen? No. And the sad fact is, and we keep repeating this, the most effective thing, and every scientist and every doctor has said this, the most effective thing to get us over this disease is for the rest of the adult population in this country to get vaccinated. And because of the political climate we live in, that's not happening. So now we have vaccinations for kids. Good, not the solution. We have the third shot now for Pfizer vaccines, the booster for mainly for older folks and people in sort of, you know, environments where they're more susceptible. Another good solution. Does it head, I don't know, does it make that much headway, you know, in the overall sort of fight against this disease? Again, not as much. So it's good news, but it just feels like we keep throwing stuff at the wrong wall.
So I had an opportunity to speak to a couple of people at UK healthcare, a couple of doctors. One's in the pediatric ward, and another one works with COVID patients. Both of them do, and I got a lot of really good information, kind of just about why it is important to get vaccinated. One of the things that they were saying is that with the way that antibodies show up in two different people who get COVID and are able to, you know, to work through it and survive, their level of antibodies is it's non-consistent. One person could have way more antibodies or way less, and they also don't know how long these antibodies will last. Now, one of the things that the science is showing that if you had COVID and you get vaccinated, you have much more protection than someone who got vaccinated who never caught the virus. So why am I saying all of that? Because there's a myriad of misinformation out there. And I think, Dan, everything you said is spot on. And it's just really frustrating that we can't seem to get more adults vaccinated, and it's because of this political nonsense that, you know, frankly, I don't know. It really makes me sad. But you know, the information is out there, and doctors are working day in and day out. Medical, you know, professionals are working day in and day out to protect and learn more about this. So, like, if you're confused about, well, this is not what they said before, this is how science works. That when presented with new information, they take that and go with it. That's how it works. So just because something was true 6 months ago and now we have new information and evidence to prove that that's not entirely true, but here is what it is, that's what we go with because that's how science works. And I'm excited. Well, excited is probably a weird thing to say. I'm glad that, you know, that young kids are going to be able to get vaccinated. But it's still not enough. We all have to do our part. And it's just really frustrating that we're having to have this same conversation day in, day out. And another thing I will say about the boosters, one thing that was shared with me that I didn't quite understand until this conversation is the Pfizer and Moderna shots themselves are both different sizes. And with the way that the boosters are going, you know, if you had Pfizer, you just get another shot of the same dose. But with Moderna, one of the things that they were saying was that you would receive half as much of one of the doses from Moderna, which is why the conversation around, well, should you mix and match? The answer is, I don't know. So that's just what I'm sharing.
Yeah, a lot of information. And honestly, like, as you said, science evolves and changes, and we keep adapting as we learn more information. A new study out of NYU that's been publicized by Washington Post filed this one under water is wet. Black-owned small businesses trying to get the PPP loan, the Paycheck Protection Program loan back in this last year and a half. Guess what? There has been racial bias shown in loans given out, particularly by smaller banks. It seemed like, for the most part, larger banks like the Chases and the Wells Fargos, there wasn't a lot of racial bias in their application and approval processes over different groups. And with online lenders, where a lot of the applications are pretty much automated, there wasn't a lot. Where the racial bias came into play were smaller banks, where humans made decisions. And there were a lot fewer loans given out or approved from smaller banks to Black-owned businesses. Now, not shocking to some degree, the galling thing about all of this is the PPP loans were guaranteed by the government. There was literally no risk to banks to give out these loans. Literally none. They were going to be covered by the government. So, you know, racism, it's in every part of our lives, and we can't escape it.
There are so many, like, there are so many places in this entire conversation where, like, we can point to, oh, color me shocked, you know, like, even going back to earlier in the pandemic when these were giving, you know, getting doled out. I know Tom Brady's company, you know, received PPE loans. The Los Angeles Lakers received PPE loans. And like, it is so disappointing that like, even in a global pandemic, when the goal should be, hey, let's put all of these other things aside and just give out money to support people who need it. You still have organizations that are kind of trying to cut in line and you know, and I'm saying this as a Laker fan. I love the Los Angeles Lakers, but I do not love that they got a PPE loan. They don't need one. Like, you're a multi-million dollar organization. You will be fine. But, you know, a small business, you know, it's not the same. It's not the same risk. So yeah, this is not surprising whatsoever.
In other news, I got three names to throw to you, and you, DeBron, I know will. I'm waiting already for the shaking of the head to begin. We're going to talk kind of in a little bundle here. We're going to talk about Sage Steele. We're going to talk about Letitia Wright, and we're going to talk about Dave Chappelle. Sage Steele is a Black woman ESPN anchor. She got pulled off the air after having made some anti-vax comments, but also her assertion that Barack Obama is not really Black because he never knew his father and he was raised by a white mother. Boom. Letitia Wright plays Shuri in the Black Panther series. By a lot of accounts, she is perhaps going to take up the mantle of Black Panther in the second Black Panther movie, which is either in production or in post-production right now. She has retweeted or reposted some anti-vax stuff and apparently has also espoused some anti-vax stuff on the set of the movie. And we finish with Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle has been one of my favorite comedians, you know, from the past couple of decades. Just done really, really interesting work. He's always had really interesting things to say, but feels like he's kind of falling down this rabbit hole and and to some degree self-inflicted wounds of transphobic, just, I think comedians, when cornered, they go back to this whole thing, like, it's a joke, why can't you take a joke? And then they double down and they keep doing it some more. The head of Netflix, Dave Chappelle, has a new special out, and this is what the controversy's around, that has a lot of problematic, toxic content. The head of Netflix has already said, we're not going to pull the show because we're making too much money. It's too popular. People are talking about it too much. So there you go. Those three together, and eagerly awaiting your take on this.
I will be very careful with my words here. In regards to Sage Steele, I would like to take kind of the follow the lead of many other black journalists that have left ESPN. So there's Maria Taylor, Michael Smith, Jamel Hill, Elsie Granderson is no longer with ESPN. There are many black reporters who have at ESPN have recounted difficult experiences with Sage Steele. What Sage Steele said is not new to kind of what she has said in the past. You know, she has had some problematic behaviors and spoken out for a myriad of things. And I think that as a person in the United States of America, that is your right to be able to express how you feel. Given that ESPN just went through this whole situation with Rachel Nichols, where she was caught on a hot mic talking about, Malika Taylor or Malika Andrews and Maria Taylor, basically kind of being brought in to quote unquote take her spot. Here's the thing with intersectionality. If we decide to play the oppression Olympics, nobody wins whatsoever. And so I understand, like, this whole situation in terms of ESPN, like, and I think why they decided to sideline Sage Steele is a direct result of how they handled the Rachel Nichols situation, because as of right now, she is no longer at the at ESPN. They kind of pulled her show, The Jump, and replaced, they're still kind of in talks with things. And the new host of NBA Countdown is going to be Mike Greenberg. There's a whole shakeup there happening. You can't tying that to Rachel Nichols and then, Jamel Hill being, well, Jamel Hill wasn't let go. Jamel Hill left on her own, but she received a bunch of, a lot of criticisms for calling 45 a white supremacist, which he is. If it walks like a duck and looks like a duck, then it's a duck. There's that. But a lot of times, we'll see specifically from the white right wing, there will be black people who have maybe a conservative viewpoint or things like that, and they'll be kind of carried as a torch of white supremacy. Larry Elder in California was recently used for this. Candace Owens is a big mouthpiece for a lot of that. And Sage Steele, by Jay Cutler, was called the Candace Owens of ESPN. So when she spoke out on President Obama, I do find it funny because I'm pretty sure that Sage Steele is also mixed. That was one of those things I was just like, why are we talking? Because, like, personally, I'm not going to go anywhere and disparage another black person publicly. That's just not my thing. I don't believe in that. I think that if I got a problem with somebody, I'm going to talk with you about it. And that's going to be it. So that's part of this whole problematic thing. So there's that. Moving to Letitia Wright. She had shared many anti-vax type of things prior to, like, right after Black Panther came out. And I think that a lot of people tried to kind of put a kibosh on that. And it is really disappointing to hear her on set kind of saying the same things. And apparently production was kind of shut down for a minute because of a potential COVID exposure, which I don't know who it was, but I can guess. Again, I don't know who it was, but it is a pretty difficult thing to think about, you know, especially given just everything that we've gone through. And again, I understand Black people's hesitancy in the United States. I get it. Trust me, I do. This is not what this is, but I understand that hesitancy. But when you're intentionally, like when you have a platform and you're intentionally spewing false information, that's the problem. Now, going on to Dave Chappelle, I will say that I have not seen The Closer. I do plan to watch it mainly because I want to be able to have an informed opinion on it on my own. That being said, I totally, based on the last two specials that Dave Chappelle had, he made some pretty transphobic jokes that weren't even really all that funny. And, you know, I feel like as a general rule in comedy, like you want to punch up and not punch down. Now, I think that Dave Chappelle is a lot smarter than he's giving himself credit for in this. And I think that Dave Chappelle very well could be the comedian to be able to have these conversations about through an intersectional lens. But that's not what's happening. It's a whole us versus them thing. And bringing up LZ Granderson again, they wrote a really great article in the LA Times kind of about their reaction to Dave Chappelle and, you know, how much in the Black community we love him. And for LZ as a gay person, you know, how hurtful some of it was. But it really just felt like, as much as I hate to say it, I would like to see Dave Chappelle grow, but it just sounds like he's just refusing to change. Like the jokes on the Chappelle show are dated, but also Eddie Murphy made many homophobic jokes in the 80s and has since apologized for them and even adapted his own, you know, style of comedy to reflect with what's going on. I feel like I've been super long-winded on this, but I will just wrap this up by saying that, like, if you're an artist, you have to be able to adapt to the times. And if you have a platform, what's the point of, you know, just going after an already marginalized group?
Yeah. And I think the way that, as you said, he's been punching, you know, either punching down or maybe even punching laterally to other sort of marginalized groups, it makes you realize that one of the most powerful weapons of white supremacy is working. And that's the scarcity complex of thinking if we care about X, we can't care about Y. And why is Y taking all the attention because I'm X? And thinking about it in those terms is very divisive. And I think this goes a bit beyond that. And again, it's that whole comedian thing where not only do they retreat and hunker down, but they double down and say, well, screw you if you can't take a joke.
Well, and I think one part of it as well is the fact that it also misses out on the part that most of the progress that has been made in the advancement of rights for LGBTQ plus people has been because of Black LGBTQ plus individuals. And, like, you know, it just, again, that lack of intersectionality of this, it's like, well, you're one way or another. It's like, well, you're erasing an entire group of people, and these people are already erased within their own history of the telling of a lot of these stories. And it's just very harmful. And, you know, I don't know. I'm pretty disappointed. Speaking of things to be disappointed about, Dan, bear with me. So I grew up in the Bay Area, and I grew up, you know, in terms of football, there's two teams in the Bay. There's the Raiders and the 49ers. Now, the Raiders have, you know, bounced back and forth between Oakland and L.A., and now they're in Las Vegas. But one of the most kind of storied coaches with the franchise is John Gruden. John Gruden led, you know, he coached the Raiders for a brief period of time in the 90s, early 2000s, led them and took them almost to the AFC Conference Championship. Then in 2002, went to go coach the Buccaneers. And in 2003, the Buccaneers defeated the Oakland Raiders at the time. to, you know, win a Super Bowl. Now, you know, he went on to coach him a few more seasons and then be on Monday Night Football for a long time and then came back with this really lucrative contract with the Raiders. And in the as part of the investigation into the Washington football team and the incredible toxic culture over there were some emails that were uncovered coming from John Gruden about you know, just various things. And it was this chain with Bruce Allen and the head of the creator, the founder of Hooters, and a couple of other people. And in these conversations, now these emails go back all the way to 2011 and go from 2011 to 2018. So it's a big chunk of time. And in these particular emails, John Gruden has used racial epithets and slurs, depicting and calling the president of the NFL Players Association, Demaurice Smith, you know, kind of using some racial stereotypes about his lips. He is a black man. Also, he made a comment about how he requested that Jeff Fisher not sign Michael Sam, who would have at the time been the NFL's first openly gay player. He is the first openly gay player signed to a practice squad. And Carl Nassib, who currently plays for the Raiders, is the NFL's first openly gay player. But in addition to that, he made many misogynistic comments about female referees. Also joked and diminished the conversation around CTE and the NFL's protocols with that. And so anyways, all of this to say is that this dude is an absolute pile of garbage. And what I kind of wanted to talk to you about, Dan, was kind of going to Chappelle's point, but really actually diving into it the way that it needs to be. So, you know, when earlier this weekend, when the email that was out was only the email about Maurice Smith and, you know, referring to him as, you know, having big lips and whatnot. This was a controversy and people were talking about, well, you know, what's going to happen, this, this, and that. And then once the flood of all these other emails came out, then John Gruden finally resigned. And I'm going to turn this over to you, but I just want to read to you what his apology was, because it definitely takes one for, it's one for the ages. Okay, so he said, "I have resigned as head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders. I love the Raiders organization and do not want to be a distraction. Thank you to all the players, coaches, staff, and fans of Raider Nation. I am sorry. I never meant to hurt anyone." Oh, on top of that, he also said that Eric Reed, who is a partner of Colin Kaepernick, should not be, you know, should not have a job, and, you know, talked a lot about the anthem protest. So anyways, the hypocrisy of the NFL taking this long to even do anything, given that I haven't watched an NFL game since Kaepernick last took a snap. So anyways, this is garbage, but I wanted to at least hear your thoughts on this.
You know, it, in the pantheon of disingenuous apologies, this is pretty great. I mean, it's I never meant to hurt anybody. Given the stuff that has come out about him, that is demonstrably false. This is not an accident. This is not a slip of the tongue. This is not, I didn't know what that word meant. This is not, I didn't know the historical context of some, you know, phrase that I threw out. This is none of those things. This is a pattern and a history of, you know, derogatory and problematic stuff. So it's pretty much a non-apology. And in some ways, like even his resignation, like it feels like he's getting away with something, you know, even still. And I imagine, I don't know any of this, and you might, I imagine there's probably some kind of severance. There's probably some kind of packages. I mean, these people, you know, people don't leave these organizations without some sort of parachute, no matter their offenses.
Well, yeah. So John Gruden's deal with the Raiders was that not only was he head coach, but he also had the power of general manager and was making like $60 million on top of his regular like coach salary. So there's a lot of money for him to lose. And like, I really just, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like you felt comfortable saying these things in private, but you're not going to say them to people, you know, to people in person. And then be like, oh, I'm sorry that I didn't mean to offend anybody. Yes, you did when you used homophobic and racial and misogynistic slurs. Like, there's no getting out of that. But anyway, let's stop talking about garbage people and talk about some good things. Getting into music this week, one of the benefits of my job is being exposed to new music on a pretty regular basis and some things that might fly across my radar that I probably wouldn't find for several more months sometimes show up a little bit earlier. So Cat Power has a new album coming out. It's a covers album. It's coming out on January 14th. And on it, you know, she does plenty of covers, but she does a cover of Frank Ocean's Bad Religion, and it's awesome. And so I cannot wait to hear this album in full. But Cat Power doing Frank Ocean was not on my list of things for the pandemic, but I'm glad it happened.
Unlike you, I am really bad and kind of just odd about discovering music. I discover random things. I'll get obsessed about an album that came out 4 years ago because I just never heard of it. But this month, I discovered an album actually around the time it came out. It's the new album by Churches, Churches with a V instead of a U. It's called Screen Violence, and I haven't stopped listening to it for the last several weeks. It's for me, the perfect blend of sort of rock and pop and synthy. Lauren Newberry just has this beautiful voice, and the songs have a little bit of a dark edge to them, but still just like great beats. They write some just killer hooks. And on one song, there's a little guest appearance by Robert Smith from The Cure, which adds a nice tinge of, you know, gloomy retro vibes. In particular, a song called Final Girl that's really, really great. And I think the first time I listened to it, I just rewound and listened to it, I think, 5 or 6 times in a row. And when we get into books, there's a little fun tie-in there, too. So that's been my obsessive listening. It's Church's new album, Screen Violence.
The Cure, just sidebar, is one of the best concerts I've ever been to. I saw them when I was right after I graduated high school, and it was it was an experience. Well, moving into one of my favorite topics of this show, this week in Anderson .Paak. Well, Dan, you know, as we were kind of wrapping up the fund drive last week, I was talking to one of my coworkers about the Silk Sonic project. And I was just like, you know, it sucks that we got to wait till February of 2022 to get, the album. And then later that afternoon, from the official Silk Sonic account and also Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak, we have a release date for the new Silk Sonic album. It is coming out on November 12th. Friday, November 12th is the day. So we're getting it a whole lot earlier. I'm very excited about it. And they've shared a picture of Anderson and Bruno Mars and Bootsy Collins. It's a whole time. I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm going to give you credit on that because this is not something I believe in normally, but I think you manifested that. Pretty sure.
I mean, if I did, cool. But it could have been somebody else manifested it, and I just noticed it at the same time. But either way, I'm really excited about it. Well, moving into TV and movies, we've got a few things to talk about. I've been to the movie theaters three times now in the pandemic, which is, if you've heard, my apprehension about even being in public is a big thing for me. So I'll talk about this real quick. I went and saw the sequel to Venom, Venom, Let There Be Carnage. And if you are an MCU fan, there is a slight connection in the post-credits scene. And if you had seen the movie, the previous movie before it, I was, you know, it was entertaining. I will say that it was directed by Andy Serkis, and I just expected a lot more, like CGI, the motion capture thing. Like what they had was cool. I just kind of expected a little bit more of it, given that Andy Serkis was the director. But it only ran about an hour and 37 minutes, so it was a short film comparative to, you know, some of the other superhero movies that we've been getting. But Woody Harrelson as Cletus Kasady is something that that's definitely worth watching the film. And then, of course, I have to just give a shout out to The Masked Singer. It is back, and it is one of my it is a lot of fun, and at least gives me some joy in these whatever the times you want to call it.
Yeah, this has been a huge week for me, movie and TV wise. We went together and saw the new James Bond movie, No Time to Die, which, spoiler alert, is Daniel Craig's last outing as James Bond. We kind of speculated a little bit about what the next steps were going to be. I'm not necessarily optimistic about how creative or daring the studio is going to get with recasting that role, and whether or not the great thing is, I think it does open that studio and that franchise up to not be, strictly speaking, James Bond. It could just be another 007. But overall, very entertaining. And the new iteration, the Daniel Craig Bond, has been an interesting iteration that's different from the rest of the franchise, in that it's kind of a series of interconnected stories where, and I realized that going in, first 10 minutes, I was like, wait, who's Vesper Lynd again? Oh, okay. It took me a second to get back into that. Watch Squid Game, which has, I think, as of this recording, is the most watched show in the history of Netflix. Was very disappointed by the end. It's gotten rave reviews by the public and by critics. It's got a great premise. Not even going to explain it, because I assume a lot of people have seen it, but interesting premise, interesting sort of set pieces in the beginning, but ultimately very flat, one-dimensional portrayals of characters. There were some story points that didn't make any sense. And those of you who have seen it, let me just say, the episode VIPs just ruined it. Just took the whole show for me to a screeching halt. It was so terrible. It was like almost hard to watch. It made me almost want to do Mystery Science 3000 on top of it. Like, it was that level of bad. But for a bingeable show, I would recommend Money Heist, a Spanish sort of bank heist thriller series that is in its fifth season, and I believe the fifth is the final season. It's been on my watch list for forever, and I just never tackled it because I was like, oh, I don't have the time and commitment to go for a show that's like four or five seasons deep. I said that, I had an afternoon free one Saturday, I started watching it, and next thing I knew, I had watched 11 of the 13 episodes of season one, and then I finished it the next day. Just super riveting, a definitely deep genre piece, but so good. Great twists and turns, great character arcs and stories, just fun, full of good looking people, and, you know, lots of twists and turns that hold up okay under scrutiny. And ultimately, it's so riveting that you don't really scrutinize it all that hard. And then why The Last Man? Now, have you gotten into it as per my constant nudging?
Your nudges are acknowledged, and I just have not had time, but I plan to try to do that this week.
Yeah, we'll do a deeper dive into why The Last Man. It's a weekly series from FX on Hulu. Really, really well done so far. just has a lot more depth than what you expect out of sort of a speculative fiction genre piece, and has really, really interesting things to say about gender, because its basic premise is built kind of on a gender essentialism. You know, the book was written 20 years ago, and the way they have adapted it to today's sort of political, social, you know, cultural climate has been really, really interesting. So I look forward to your take on that. But I know what we definitely can talk about is the finale of Marvel's What If. Go.
Well, before we get to that, I do just want to say that when we were walking out of Skyfall, you know, I was talking about how No Time to Die. I was saying, I was like, oh man, I wish I had watched Spectre, and I completely forgot that Skyfall was a movie that I had seen. I echo everything Dan said on Bond, and especially if you are a Bond fan, it very much has all of the things that you expect. Plus, some more things that have been long overdue, and I'll just leave it at that.
I will add one more thing about Bond. The scenes with Ana de Armas are worth the price of admission alone. She is great, and I hope she returns.
Well, let's talk about What If. I have a lot of feelings about What If, and I will just start by saying, you know, we knew going into this that we would have four portrayals of you know, Chadwick Boseman as a version of T'Challa, and the season finale of the What If episode is the fourth iteration. We see him again as Star-Lord T'Challa. And so, like, before we get into this conversation, I want to just acknowledge, like, you know, I was mentally prepared, you know, at some point to say goodbye to Chadwick, and I still have not seen Ma Rainey's Black Bottom for that reason. But I am just so appreciative that he took every opportunity to bring life to this character, every opportunity to uplift this character and his people. But also, like, he knew the importance of this. And I was reading an article after I finished watching the episode, and while they were in the recordings of this, Marvel was actually working a deal with him to bring Star-Lord T'Challa to an animated series and do a full Star-Lord T'Challa spinoff. And, you know, nobody knew that he was sick. And, you know, it's just, for me, it's just a reminder that we need to take time to do the things that we love and, you know, do the things that we can to bring joy to other people. So that was what I will, that's my point on that. I am still very sad about Chadwick Boseman, but oh my goodness, this episode was like, it was like Avengers Endgame, but in a slightly fast, sped up way. But like, I felt like the finale wasn't as like, the plot wasn't flown through as much as it had been in previous episodes, which I appreciated. And I thought that it was a really clever way, the way that they kind of wrapped things up.
Yeah, what I loved about it, so for, you know, spoiler warning, for those who have been following the series, it kind of started off as these sort of one-shot deals that seemed very not connected at all. And then they eventually, I think starting with the Doctor Strange episode, they started tying it all back together. And, you know, the ending premise of the last couple episodes is that Ultron is also Vision, has also gotten all of the Infinity Stones, and has decided to make the universe a better place by just destroying all of it. And then he suddenly overhears the Watcher over his shoulder, one of the great moments of that series. The Watcher is up there doing his stoic narration, and suddenly Vision, Ultron, his eyes flit, you know, looking up like he heard something. And I was like, ooh, gave me goosebumps. But yeah, the final battle against Ultron with the sort of ragtag Avengers, or they were called Guardians of the Multiverse, as chosen by the Watcher himself. This is the kind of stuff I read comic books for. This is the kind of stuff that I go see superheroes movies for. That teamwork, team showdown between one big, bad, nearly invincible villain and the creativity and teamwork and just fun of watching these heroes, you know, slug it out, especially with characters like Black Widow in the mix, which you would think Black Widow is a human spy with no superpowers. What is she doing in a fight against a god level creature? But, you know, so good, just so entertaining, a great, great finale to the series, and got me really, really invested in it the way I hadn't been when it started.
I really appreciated the way that they kind of ended the conflict that, like, you know, Killmonger and Arnim Zola were both going after the Infinity Stones. And the whole point was, oh, well, you know, they were going to do that. And you got to keep them in this little pocket dimension within a pocket dimension. And Doctor Strange, Dark Doctor Strange, is going to watch over them for all eternity. I just thought that the way that the story was written, and especially given, you know, all of the things going on, you know, it's pretty impressive. And the fact that they only had to really shelve one episode because of the pandemic, which is why if you watch the episode and you're like, who is this version of Gamora? Well, it is from the episode, was supposed to be from episode 10, where it is, what if instead of, you know, going to the planet Sakaar, it was Iron Man and Gamora. And so that's where that comes from. And I mean, it was a little bit of confusion, but like, I thought that, you know, again, it was a really well done thing. And I mean, I feel like most of us at this point are like, yeah, no, we understand why this didn't happen because, you know, COVID. But yeah, no, I really just loved the way that the conflict happened. It came and it went, and, you know, everybody got relatively positive, goodbyes. And I'm super excited to see the Hydra Stomper Steve Rogers Winter Soldier collaboration, or whatever it is that they're going to do with that. I think that's going to be really awesome.
Yeah. And I think setting up the idea of the multiverse here definitely kind of gets us primed for the new Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. So again, always friggin' impressive how the MCU and Marvel has just done kind of an amazing job of not just telling great standalone stories, but being able to tie all these threads together and keep kind of, you know, pulling you along with this whole just sort of ever growing, ever expanding, kind of like a universe, ever expanding universe of stories. So kudos, really enjoyable. And actually, as we're talking about it, I kind of want to watch the last four episodes of the show again.
And maybe one day we can get a live action Marvel Zombies. That would be pretty cool.
Cool. That'd be something. I would go for an entire Marvel Zombie series for sure.
There you go. Well, moving into books, you've got something that you've been that's been on your shelf this week.
Yeah, in the same week that I discovered the Church's song that I'm obsessed with called Final Girl, I came across, I think it was a loaner that somebody had lent my wife Lauren, called the Final Girl Support Group. For those who don't know, here comes your explanatory comma. The final girl is sort of a horror movie trope of the last remaining survivor, often a young woman, in the sort of slasher trope. You know, the jock gets killed, the slut gets killed, the nerd gets killed, you know, all these sort of stereotypes get killed. And then the final girl usually is somebody fairly innocent, but she somehow survives. And in the context of this book, the final girl is something, the person that also kills her attacker, kills the villain, kills the murderer. So the premise of this book by Grady Hendrix, premise of this book is that it takes place in the real world, and there's a support group of, I think, six women of different ages who have survived serial killers, basically serial murderers. And in this world, most of their stories have been turned into fictionalized versions. So some of them are kind of premised on like a Nightmare on Elm Street or a Halloween or a Friday the 13th situation. So, and then the story kind of kicks off when it seems like there's a conspiracy. It seems like somebody is going after these final girls one by one. It is kind of really well-written trash. It is just riveting. It's visceral. It's there's an exploitation vibe to it, which you kind of can't help when you're in this sort of genre. But it was a breezy read. I blew through it in, I think, 2 or 3 days. And I think that's kind of Grady Hendrix's lane too. He does a lot of sort of really breezy, fun to read sort of genre fiction. So Final Girl Support Group by Grady Hendrix.
Well, as we roll into pandemic advice, you know, again, I had the opportunity to have a conversation with a couple of people from UK healthcare. And, you know, one thing that I just want to say to uplift them is, like, when I was interviewing them, it was like they were trying to make sure that everything that needed to be said was said. Everything that they said was with a sense of urgency and with a sense of sincerity and true empathy for people. You know, and the biggest walk away for me was healthcare workers want to save lives. They want to save lives. It is not always something that they are successful at because that is the nature of the business, but they want to save lives. And especially with this vaccine, you know, I could sit here and play our thing, but, you know, ultimately what I feel is important is they want us to live. And in order for us to be able to do that, we have to do what we can for one another and, you know, do what we got to do. So if you're not vaccinated and you don't plan on getting vaccinated, that is your choice. But please continue to do what you can by, you know, practicing social distancing, wearing a mask, and, you know, just trying to keep everyone else safe. Because this whole conversation about it's my freedom. No, it's about the freedom to support other people and protect other people. That's what it is. So that's what I'm going to leave you with this week. And Dan, I pass it off to you.
Get vaccinated. Also, get your flu shot. I got my flu shot this morning. Basically, Kroger, all the pharmacies, health department, you can get a flu shot anywhere. You can get it for free. It's easy. It's simple. It's something you should be doing every single fall. The great thing is we are entering into fall, and fall means the weather is nice. It's not so crazy hot anymore. It's also not cold and drizzly and rainy yet. It's good weather. It's good weather to be outside. It's good weather to hang out with friends. I think everybody I talk to is always more comfortable outside, especially if your circle or your event is bigger than just your small little friend group or your family group. Do stuff outside, have picnics, have outings. When you go get coffee, sit on the patio. I mean, enjoy this weather, and it'll keep you safe.
And with that, it brings us to a close. This has been episode 31 of Advanced D&D, a podcast from WUKY, hosted by Dan Wu and DeBron Thomas. This has been fun. This has been one of our longer episodes, and we hope that you've enjoyed the conversation, and we will talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.